Ali Shamkhani said the path to an agreement will be clear and smooth if the U.S. enters the talks with honesty and will for an agreement. The Saturday's talks in Moscow will be attended by Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi and U.S. Regional Envoy Steve Witkoff. Political analyst Sayed Mohammad Marandi told us earlier that Iran will never relinquish its conventional military capabilities and support for its regional allies.
Iran is not going to relinquish its conventional military capabilities at all. It is not going to compromise on that. It is not going to compromise on its support for regional allies. It has shown the Iranians that Iran, that it is willing to compromise within the framework of international law with regards to easing any potential concerns about nuclear weapons. We saw that in 2015, we saw that before 2015, and we saw it during the Trump, during the Biden years as well, when Dr. Baghri was negotiating a deal, and we literally had a deal 3 years ago, but the Americans walked away at the last moment, even though the Europeans supported the final text. So the problem does not lie in Tehran. The problem lies in Washington. But Washington also has many other problems. It has a trade war that's not going well. It is fighting a dirty war in Ukraine, which has not come to an end. And with regards to Iran, Iran's defense capabilities and its conventional weapons would mean that any war with Iran or any major conflict with Iran would devastate the global economy and the U.S. economy in particular.
The Israeli military continues to pound Gaza around the clock, killing more civilians in the Palestinian territory. 18 people, including women and children, lost their lives in fresh attacks on two neighborhoods in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Two other Palestinians were also killed in a strike on Beit Lahia in northern Gaza. Israel has been bombarding Gaza after around 2 months of relative respite. Since the regime ended the ceasefire there, over 1,500 Palestinians have lost their lives. The death toll from the genocidal war since October 2023 is nearing 50,900. Well, thousands of Yemeni people have taken to the streets of the northern city of Sada in yet another pro-Palestine rally amid the genocidal war on Gaza. The protesters carried flags of Yemen and Palestine, chanting slogans in support of the resistance against the Israeli regime. They expressed support for anti-Israel operations by the Yemeni armed forces. Pro-Palestine rallies have been held almost routinely in Yemen on Fridays since the beginning of the genocidal war on Gaza. Chinese President Xi Jinping has called on the European Union to join hands with his country in resisting unilateral bullying, as both Beijing and the EU are targeted by the U.S. president's tariffs. During a meeting in Beijing with the Spanish Prime Minister, Xi said China and Europe should fulfill their international responsibilities. The Chinese president also warned that U.S. trade policies could make the country an isolated island on the global stage, adding that there are no winners in a trade war. Xi made the comments as Trump has announced a 90-day pause on higher tariffs for dozens of countries, except for China, that is facing levies as high as 145% on exports to the U.S. Trump had also declared a 20% tariff on goods from the European Union, which is now subject to the pause for 90 days. Staying with Donald Trump's trade war, the U.S. stock market is feeling the whiplash over Trump's tariff policies. Almost all major U.S. stock indexes suffered losses on Thursday. The S&P 500 tumbled 3.5%, while the Nasdaq Composite slid 4.3%. East Asian markets also came back deep in negative territory. Seoul, Singapore, and Bangkok were in the red, while Tokyo shed 3%. Meanwhile, the U.S. dollar index tumbled, hitting its lowest level since early October. The dollar has broadly weakened this year amid growing concerns about the stability of the U.S. economy. A helicopter crash near the U.S. city of New York has claimed the lives of all six people on board. The helicopter went down in the Hudson River just 15 minutes after it took off from the Wall Street heliport. Videos coming from the scene of the accident show the aircraft mostly submerged, upside down in the water. The passengers were a family of five Spanish tourists who died along with the pilot. Four of the victims were pronounced dead on the scene, while two others succumbed to their injuries at the local hospitals. The cause of the crash is under investigation. Well, in the Spanish city of Cordoba, a conference has been held to highlight the Israeli media propaganda and framing the narrative of the Gaza war in the regime's favor. Alberto Garcia tells us more.
To defend our Palestinian professor Wazam Amer, dean of the Faculty of Communication at Gaza and researcher at Cambridge, delivers a critical conference on the international media coverage of the Israeli war on Gaza. He analyzes the biases and misinformation in US, UK, and German media, highlighting how they align with Israeli narratives, often omitting crucial historical and geopolitical context.
And the Israeli crimes and genocide in Gaza has been manipulated in many ways. One of the ways is the labeling of the Israeli genocide as Israel-Hamas war rather than Israeli war on Gaza or Israel war on the Palestinians.
Professor Amer examines how Western media coverage has contributed to disinformation and eroded journalistic credibility. He emphasizes the need to address these biases to ensure accurate, balanced, and responsible reporting on conflicts and their humanitarian consequences.
One way of the manipulation is the missing context of the October 7th events. Western media outlets mainly portray the events of October as if they are the starting point of the conflict, ignoring the whole political and historical context. You know, in Gaza before October 7th, we had been living under Israeli blockade and siege for 17 years. And the Israeli siege and Israeli genocide came in the context of the Israeli occupation.
With deep insight into how audiovisual media shape public opinion, Professor Amer offered a first-hand account of Gaza's early conflict, an expert view that challenges mainstream narratives.
Professor Wazam Amer reveals how unverified claims distort coverage, highlighting the marginalization of Palestinian voices and the use of language that reinforces biased narratives.
This conference in Cordoba highlights how Western media distorts the Palestinian suffering, obscure the realities of occupation and genocide, and promote Israeli narratives. The conference is an effort to offer a critical examination of media manipulation in the coverage of Israel's war on Gaza. Alberto Garcia, Cordoba.
Well, British police in London have arrested six people after environmental activists from an NGO named Greenpeace poured 300 liters of blood red dye into a pond outside the U.S. Embassy. The activists were detained on suspicion of criminal damage and conspiracy to cause criminal damage. Among those arrested is a co-executive director of the Greenpeace in the U.K. According to the NGO, 12 activists carried out the action outside the U.S. Embassy using non-toxic biodegradable dye from containers labeled Stop Arming Israel. The Greenpeace stated that the protest was aimed at highlighting the death and devastation in Gaza as a direct result of Washington's continued provision of weapons and ammunition to the Israeli regime. Well, tensions are running high in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military continues with its violent raids while Palestinian resistance fighters are fighting back against the regime's forces. The Jenin Brigade says it has carried out an improvised explosive device attack on Israeli military vehicles at the entrance to the town of Silat al-Harithiya in Jenin. Also, the military wing of the Islamic Jihad reported battles with the IOF troops in several areas of the old city in Nablus. The Palestinian resistance comes amid deadly incursions by Israeli soldiers and settler attacks. The escalation on the West Bank began shortly after the end of the Gaza ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. In Argentina, a one-day nationwide strike has paralyzed much of the country's economic activity as unrest grows over President Javier Milei's drastic policy maneuvers. Camila Escalante brings us more on this story from Buenos Aires.
Argentina's main unions convened a massive mobilization in Buenos Aires as anger boils over the economic policies being imposed by President Javier Milei. Protesters denounced austerity measures, privatizations, mass layoffs, and rising unemployment and poverty as the country reaches a new $20 billion debt agreement with the IMF.
We are fighting for the labor rights that have been taken away from us for the retirees and for the country, which is a disaster. The truth is that this is the worst thing that has happened to us. He's a doormat of the United States.
In this country, there's deep inequality between those who have the most and those who have nothing. They're unable to complete their daily meals. We hope that these protests continue.
Opposition to the Milei administration is being led by pensioners who for months have carried out weekly protests condemning the government for allowing old age citizens to sink into poverty.
They are selling our country to the great world powers. We are not going to surrender. We are not going to allow this government or any other right-wing government to do so.
Labor leaders say the government is dismantling the state and waging a war on workers, while Milei subordinates the fate of the nation to the geopolitical whims of the United States.
The president is a man put by the U.S. Embassy in the Latin American chapter. He is an employee of the interests of U.S. imperialism in Argentina, and he is devastating everything that has to do with the resources that the country has, while at the same time he is subjecting the population to unnecessary scarcity.
The mobilization ushers in a 24-hour strike, paralyzing much of the country's economic activity against what protesters call Javier Milei's disastrous economic restructuring policies, all guided by corporate and foreign interests. Camila Escalante, Buenos Aires.
Please stay tuned for more updates. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
U.S. President Donald Trump sent a letter to Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, through the United Arab Emirates. In this letter, Trump expressed his desire to negotiate a nuclear deal with Iran. This request followed his executive order in early February, which threatened maximum pressure on Tehran. Washington claims that the aim is to ensure Iran is denied a nuclear weapon and intercontinental ballistic missiles. In response, Iran formally communicated through Oman, indicating their reluctance for direct negotiations but openness to indirect talks. On March 30, 2025, in reaction to Iran's dismissal, Trump warned that if a nuclear agreement with the U.S. was not reached, Iran could face military action, including bombings and the reimposition of secondary tariffs like those from his previous administration. Tehran responded that it would react decisively and immediately to any U.S. action. The goals of the current negotiations under Trump remain unclear, but they seem to extend beyond simply reviving the 2015 agreement made by the United Kingdom, France, Russia, China, and Germany, an accord the U.S. abandoned in 2018. For more than two decades, Iran's peaceful nuclear program has become a bone of contention between the country and the West, especially the United States of America. And now, after all talks and negotiations, the situation is more strained than ever. In his first term, President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2018. This international agreement had placed constraints on Iran's nuclear program in exchange for lifting sanctions. The deal aimed to extend the breakout time, the period required for a country to develop a nuclear weapon, to about 1 year. However, following the U.S. withdrawal, the agreement fell apart, and Iran resumed uranium production and enrichment beyond the JCPOA's limits, significantly reducing the breakout time. Mr. Heshmatullah Falahatpishe, a seasoned Iranian politician who has served multiple terms in the Iranian parliament. Once the chair of the National Security and Foreign Policy Commission in Parliament, Mr. Falahatpishe is currently a faculty member at Allame Tabatabai University, where he teaches political science.
When Trump took office, Iran had accepted the JCPOA, which was focused solely on peaceful nuclear activities, and clarified its non-pursuit of nuclear weapons. Iran even allowed the International Atomic Energy Agency to revisit its nuclear site more than required as a goodwill gesture. However, Trump undermined this agreement by insisting Iran must entirely abandon its nuclear program, a critical technology for its scientific advancement and energy needs. It demanded Iran halt all nuclear activities before the U.S. would lift sanctions, a position lacking in logic. In 2018, Trump abruptly withdrew from the JCPOA, striking the first blow to the agreement. The second came from Biden, who initially stated he would re-enter the JCPOA, but instead continued Trump's maximum pressure policy, hoping to extract more concessions from Iran. After realizing Iran would not back down on its nuclear program and was heading toward 60% uranium enrichment, Biden initiated negotiations to revive the JCPOA, but by that time it was too late as significant regional developments were underway. In essence, the JCPOA's revival was sacrificed for the Ukraine war.
Iran's nuclear program dates back to the 1950s, initiated with U.S. assistance under the Shah's regime, which signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. However, the program halted after the Islamic Revolution in 1979. It was revived after a bloody war launched by Saddam's Iraq and backed by the West, leaving behind nearly 300,000 casualties in Iran.
In the 7th and 8th parliaments, we enacted nuclear legislations emphasizing that the government must prioritize the complete nuclear fuel cycle to achieve peaceful nuclear technology. This reflects our commitment to both a comprehensive fuel cycle and the peaceful purpose of this technology. The parliament specifically mandated the government to pursue peaceful nuclear capabilities within the framework of the NPT. This is crucial because over 700 scientific fields benefit from nuclear advancements. By embracing nuclear technology, which serves as a foundational technology, Iran can progress scientifically alongside the global community. Otherwise, it risks falling behind.
The West responded with a carrot-and-stick approach, imposing sanctions while demanding Iran halt its nuclear program. Iran, in turn, asserted its undeniable right to a peaceful nuclear program, leading to several rounds of negotiations aimed at reaching a diplomatic resolution. These efforts culminated in the 2015 JCPOA, under which Iran agreed to cut its enriched uranium stockpile by 98%, freezing enrichment at 3.67%, and permit comprehensive inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. In exchange, sanctions linked to its nuclear program would be lifted with a snapback provision in the event of Iran violating the terms of the agreement. From the very beginning, Israel opposed the JCPOA. As the only nuclear weapons power in the region, Israel perceived an Iranian nuclear capability as an existential threat. In 2013, during the negotiations, Prime Minister Netanyahu addressed the U.S. Congress, declaring, "This is a bad deal, a very bad deal." Mr. Hossein Talebi, an expert in nuclear affairs, discussed the various actions taken by the Islamic Republic following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA. He explained that under the agreement, Iran was supposed to sell its surplus uranium fuel with the United States as the primary buyer.
At this point, Iran chose not to sell its excess uranium. Instead, it began stockpiling, amassing approximately 4.5 tons of enriched uranium today, up from just 300 kilograms back then. The second significant step was Iran's announcement that it would no longer adhere to the 3.67% enrichment limit due to unsatisfactory results from earlier commitments. Initially enriching to 4.5%, Iran subsequently increased this to 20%. Driven by internal needs for fuel for its nuclear submarines, Iran also initiated a program for 60% enrichment. Next, Iran focused on developing centrifuges. Initially, it accepted limitations on using advanced generation centrifuges, utilizing only the first generation IR-1 models at its enrichment sites, while advancing research on IR-2, IR-2M, IR-4, IR-6, and IR-8 centrifuges. Following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA, Iran discarded these limitations and continued its R&D on higher generation centrifuges. Iran discarded these limitations and continued its R&D on higher generation centrifuges. Iran also initially agreed to cease enrichment at the strategic Fordo facility. So while the site continued operations, it did not produce enriched material. After the U.S. withdrawal, Iran injected nuclear gas there, effectively reinstating it into the enrichment process. Ultimately, Iran declared it would no longer accept any limitations imposed by the JCPOA and would freely pursue its necessary nuclear programs.
The turning point came when Donald Trump took office in 2017, and a year later, in May 2018, he ordered a U.S. withdrawal from the deal and reimposition of sanctions on Iran, despite the IAEA certification that Iran had fully complied with the JCPOA.
After the U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA and Iran began to scale back its commitments, the first to threaten Iran was the U.S., demanding that Iran fulfill its obligations despite the U.S. not honoring its own. European officials sought to preserve the agreement, which included inspections by the IAEA. As these inspections became limited, the agency's reports shifted to stating that it found no evidence of deviations in Iran's nuclear program, but could not confirm that Iran's activities were entirely peaceful, thereby expressing a desire for greater access. This demand was no longer reasonable based on the terms of the JCPOA.
The U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA received support from Israel. The regime actively sought to tighten U.S. policy towards Iran, advocating for the maximum pressure strategy. This approach led to drastic steps, including the designation of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps as a co-terrorist organization in 2019. On January 3, 2020, the U.S. assassinated Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the IRGC Quds Force, followed later that year by the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh by Israeli operatives. In the wake of General Soleimani's assassination, Iran announced it would no longer adhere to the limits set by the JCPOA. Mr. Ismail Kosari represents Tehran in parliament and has an extensive background as a former IRGC commander, having served as the deputy chief of the Sarallah headquarters, an Islamic Revolution Guard Corps unit tasked with ensuring security in Tehran.
We continued in accordance with the nuclear deal, but countries like the European members of the 5+1 group failed to meet their commitments. Consequently, the 11th Parliament enacted the Strategic Action Law to safeguard Iran's nuclear program. We officially communicated that due to the lack of commitment from the U.S. and European countries, namely Germany, the U.K. and France, this law was adopted. Thankfully, it enabled us to continue enriching uranium and increase our enrichment level to 60%, which is crucial for a large country like Iran. Although President Rouhani's government did not initially welcome it, they ultimately complied with its implementation, allowing us to proceed under this new framework.
When the Biden administration took office in 2021, there were hopes that the U.S. would rejoin the JCPOA. However, the situation did not unfold as anticipated, leaving the agreement in a state of limbo, half dead. Although negotiations commenced, they ultimately began to unravel after a year, hindered by the shifting global landscape shaped by the Ukraine war. Mr. Hassan Losjerdi from Khabar Online News Agency stated that after the effective collapse of the JCPOA, Iran advanced significantly in its nuclear program. He also remarked that Iran's actions are in line with the prevailing realities on the ground.
It has been confirmed that the Islamic Republic of Iran has developed nuclear technology capabilities, which is its natural right. Additionally, a critical point is that Iran has demonstrated its R&D capabilities, meaning it can conduct research and enhance its enrichment levels. For example, it has increased enrichment from 1% to 60%. Another key aspect is that Iran's actions are often influenced by the behavior of the opposing side. For instance, following the American withdrawal, we enacted the Strategic Action Law. When the IAEA failed to meet its commitments, Iran imposed some restrictions on surveillance. Thus, I believe the Islamic Republic has made significant efforts to operate within the NPT framework, but due to pressures from Western countries, it has sometimes imposed restrictions to encourage the other side to respect its right. Importantly, Iran is dedicated to using this technology responsibly, whether in agriculture, energy, medicine, or other relevant sectors. If Western countries inhibit Iran or any other member country from utilizing this technology, they are likely to provoke frustration, which could result in unintended consequences.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. Tehran Times. IAEA chief acknowledges Iran has no nuclear weapons, says will visit Tehran in coming weeks. In the face of renewed political rhetoric from Western powers, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has confirmed that Iran does not possess nuclear weapons despite ongoing claims surrounding its peaceful nuclear program. However, he alleged that Iran holds significant quantities of enriched uranium, a repeated claim that Iran has always rejected. These remarks, while framed within a political narrative, still reaffirm what the Islamic Republic has maintained for years. Iran's nuclear activities are peaceful, legal, and under strict international supervision. Grossi, who continues to echo political language influenced by certain Western capitals, nevertheless recognized that enriched uranium, even in significant quantities, does not constitute a nuclear weapon. Our estimate is that Iran now has enough enriched uranium for 6 or 7 weapons, he claimed, but that does not mean Iran has such weapons. Reuters. Russia says U.S. threats of military strikes against Iran are unacceptable. Asked about Iran's nuclear program and the dangers in the current situation, Russia's foreign minister says that Moscow was committed to finding solutions to Iran's nuclear program, which respected Tehran's rights to peaceful nuclear energy. The use of military force by Iran's opponents in the context of the settlement is illegal and unacceptable, Maria Zakharova, spokeswoman for the ministry, told reporters. Threats from outside to bomb Iran's nuclear infrastructure facilities will inevitably lead to an irreversible global catastrophe. These threats are simply unacceptable. Mehr News. Turkey reacts to Trump's bombing threat against Iran. Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan has reacted to the threats made by U.S. President Donald Trump on bombing Iran if a nuclear deal is not reached between Tehran and Washington. Turkey is not interested in a new source of instability in the region and does not want the U.S. to attack Iran, Fidan told Reuters. Our region cannot tolerate another war, another big source of instability, and we don't know what type of escalation might occur in case of such an attack. So, we don't want to see any U.S. attack on Iran taking place. We need to see, as was the case in the past, peaceful negotiations employed by both sides and interested parties. Iran's military chief, Tehran, not to initiate war, to respond decisively to threats. The chief of the general staff of Iran's armed forces has stated that the measures taken by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in response to the letter from U.S. President Donald Trump were based on the principle that Tehran is not the instigator of a war, but it will respond with full force to any threat. Major General Mohammad Bagheri added that another part of the measures taken in response to Trump's letter emphasizes that Iran seeks stability in the region, is not pursuing nuclear weapons, and will not engage in direct negotiations, though indirect talks are not an issue. He noted that Iran's response made it clear that the U.S. has been the most unreliable and untrustworthy party in the past negotiations, stressing that there is no trust in America. He pointed out that Trump, following his recent letter to the leader, received a fitting response, one that reflected the leader's directives and strategic considerations. Bagheri described the U.S. president as a narcissistic and bullying individual, adding that he has clashed not only with enemies, but also with friends and allies. Middle East Monitor. Iran raises alert level amid fear of war with Israel. Iran has raised its alert level and is ready to deliver immediate responses in the event of an attack against its sovereign territory, a senior source in the Iranian General Staff has revealed. Meanwhile, Mariv has claimed that the Iranian armed forces are aiming more than 1,000 hypersonic ballistic missiles at nuclear facilities in Israel. A source was quoted by the Israeli newspaper as saying that the missiles are programmed to target Israel's Dimona nuclear plant, as well as several other facilities in central Israel, where sensitive strategic sites have been transferred. Iranian forces are also aiming their missiles at U.S. military bases in the region, according to the same source. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative.
From recent American threats and statements, it's clear that President Trump wants to impose strict limits on Iran's nuclear enrichment activities, potentially even through military means. Whether these threats amount to a bluff remains uncertain.
But one thing is clear, the stakes are incredibly high.
Mr. Talebi asked reasons why a U.S. attack on Iran's nuclear facilities is unlikely.
International law, including Article 56 of the Additional Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions, prohibits attacking the nuclear facilities of any country due to potential environmental consequences and risks to civilians locally, regionally, and even globally, as demonstrated by past incidents like Chernobyl. However, the U.S. has shown a tendency to disregard international law when it sees fit, often neglecting legal obligations and using media propaganda to justify its actions. While such attacks are illegal and should not happen, there remains a possibility of U.S. violations. Yet both the U.S. and Israel are unlikely to seriously consider this option, as an attack on nuclear facilities would have extensive environmental impacts that threaten their own interests. Additionally, facilities like those in Fordo and Natanz are designed to be nearly inaccessible, and considering the protective measures implemented during their construction would likely withstand conventional weapons without sustaining significant damage.
In response to Iran's rejection of direct negotiations, Trump declared, if they don't make a deal, there will be bombing. It will be bombing the likes of which they have never seen before. Recent reports indicate that the U.S. has moved four long-range stealth B-2 bombers to the Indian Ocean base of Diego Garcia, raising concerns that Trump might follow through on his threats.
I believe it's a grave mistake for Americans to think they can advance their policies by targeting Iran's nuclear sites or transforming Iran into a state like Iraq under Saddam Hussein before his fall. Iran's defensive mechanisms won't allow it. Its defense capabilities are built for deterrence, and extensive missile programs serve to protect the nation. In the event of war, Iran would not remain passive, but would escalate any American attack into a full-scale conflict. Recently, 300 Iranian political activists issued a statement condemning any attacks on Iran, declaring their commitment to defend their country despite being critics of the political system, some of whom have even been imprisoned. Americans and Israelis must understand that if an attack occurs, the entire nation will unite against them, regardless of the discontent and difficult conditions existing in the country.
The potential for a larger conflict in West Asia poses significant regional and global repercussions. First, it remains uncertain whether a U.S. strike would effectively neutralize all Iranian nuclear facilities. An American attack followed by widespread destruction could ironically push Iran closer to developing and potentially using nuclear weapons, despite its reluctance. Nevertheless, Mr. Talebi emphasized that Iran's nuclear doctrine is deeply rooted in humanitarian values, aiming to create a better world rather than the opposite.
These Western threats raise concerns within the Iranian government, making some argue about adjusting the country's nuclear doctrine, which has always been against pursuing nuclear weapons. The U.S. had sidelined the JCPOA and continued to threaten Iran, so some argued that Iran might reconsider its nuclear doctrine. We hear this argument even today. However, the Iranian leadership affirmed that its nuclear program remains consistent. It aims to acquire, develop, operationalize, and commercialize nuclear technology for its own benefits without seeking to produce or proliferate nuclear weapons. This commitment stands regardless of the JCPOA or external pressures. It is totally based on the country's core values.
Furthermore, oil prices could surge, leading to supply shortages in global markets. Lastly, there are serious humanitarian risks associated with a strike on nuclear facilities, including the possibility of radioactive contamination, which could have devastating effects on civilian populations in the entire region, and not just Iran. Meanwhile, Mr. Losjerdi noted that the IAEA could play a constructive role in easing tensions.
من فکر میکنم که آژانس دچار یک بازی دوگانه است.
I believe the IAEA is caught in a dual game. Recently, Mr. Grossi expressed his intention to travel to Tehran to help manage the crisis. This suggests that if the agency takes timely and impartial action, it can play a constructive role in reducing tensions. At the same time, recent reports from the agency indicate that the Islamic Republic of Iran has operated within the principles of the NPT and has not violated them. So, I believe the IAEA has the potential to foster calm and build trust among the involved parties if, and it is a big if, it doesn't give in to political pressure and just focuses on its technical duties.
It's important to recognize that no military action can erase Iran's nuclear know-how. The country has a self-sufficient defense industry and a well-educated workforce capable of maintaining its nuclear capabilities. In contrast to 2015, any current negotiations are likely to be primarily an all-American affair, with only small involvement from European allies. The countries that facilitated the JCPOA back then, Russia and China, are less inclined to support Western objectives in Iran now. Both nations currently advocate for a negotiated settlement. However, in the present geopolitical climate, where Russia has established a strategic partnership with Iran and China is under U.S. pressure in the Indo-Pacific, they might opt to assist Iran's nuclear program, similar to China's past support for Pakistan. This October marks the expiration of key provisions in the JCPOA. The Europeans could well trigger the snapback process and reinstitute UN sanctions, making the current situation even more complicated. As of now, it seems that Trump is contemplating Iran's proposal for indirect talks, even while he has bolstered U.S. forces in the region in preparation for potential military strikes. White House officials assert that this buildup does not necessarily indicate imminent military action, but reflects an American desire to negotiate from a position of strength. However, for the Iranians, the situation remains unchanged. Neither the carrot nor the stick appears capable of dissuading them from upholding their legitimate right to have a peaceful nuclear program. Mr. Kosai argued that Trump's brinkmanship tactics do not intimidate Iran, a nation that has endured 8 years of war, not only against Iraq, but in fact in confrontation with Western and Eastern blocs. That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do join us again same times next week to see what else is on. Until next time, take care.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You are listening to the program Bookshelf on Iran Radio with Sheikh Yasser, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So one of the obvious events, some of us are very scared of it, some of us are terrified of it, some of us wish that it never occurs, but it will definitely occur. And it will occur to everybody, everything, in fact, is the concept of death, that everything that is not Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will be destroyed, will lose its existence, so to speak. However, what is also necessary for us to understand that when we mean death, it does not mean that we lose existence. This is not what we mean, especially within the framework of religion and especially within the Islamic theological framework. We do not mean that death is a losing of something. Rather, death is a traversing and a means by which we travel from one place to another. That is why many of the ulama have actually written books, and certain individuals and scholars have written books based on this particular understanding of death, that death is not an end, but rather a new beginning. So they have written books and have titled it with titles such as the book that we are introducing to our dear listeners today, which is titled Life After Life, that there is a new life, a new beginning that will start after death, that death is not the end. There is another life, another realm, another place that is waiting for us. But what is important is that that particular life is structured and created by our actions, our intentions, basically every single thing that we do in this life. So inshallah, to get better acquainted with this book, please stay with us and join us in our next segment, inshallah.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the book that we have introduced to our dear listeners, or the title that we have mentioned rather to our dear listeners, is Life After Life. This book was written by Muhammad Jawad Nawruzi and Amir Rasteen. So it was translated or commissioned by the management of foreign pilgrims of the Astan Quds Razavi Islamic Relations Office. That is the organization that looks after takes care of the Haram and the Mausoleum of Imam Rida alayhi salam, the 8th Holy Imam. This book was published in 2020. It was published for the first time in Mashhad. And obviously the publisher is Zaira Radhawi. That is the publishing house or the publishing that looks after or is done and under the auspices of the Haram of Imam Rida alayhi salam. And again, as we mentioned, the title of this book is Life After Life, with the Farsi title Zindagi Pas Az Zindagi. So this book, as we mentioned, looks at death and certain things that will happen, i.e. there are certain teachings within the realm of the Islamic texts, the Islamic scriptures, the Ahadith, the Quran al-Majid, that indicate certain events that will occur in the hereafter. For example, we have what is known as the interim house. This is a place where, you know, we are here, this particular zindagi or this particular life of us in this material world. And then we have what is known as barzakh, or what the author has translated as the waiting house, where we stay and we wait for the day of judgment to appear. Again, this on a very basic theological level. And for us to be judged in that particular realm, on that particular plane of existence. And therefore, the last one is the eternal house, which is the day of judgment. And also in that day of judgment is where we are placed. We are either placed because of our deeds in eternal bliss, which is represented by paradise, or in eternal damnation and wretchedness, which is represented by hell and the fire, which is a means of cleansing some people. And again, there are obviously certain discussions that can be had here. So, for example, when the chapter of the waiting house, some of the questions that may be asked is, what is the purpose of the grave? What happens in the grave? What is Yawm al-Qiyamah? And so on and so forth. So these are some of the questions that this book aims to answer. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a portion of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves?
Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So the book that we have introduced to our dear listeners is titled Life After Life. It was written by Muhammad Jawad Nowruzi and published by the publishing house of Arslan Khosrowshahi, the International Relations or the Islamic Relations Office in Mashhad, again, the Shrine of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. So the portion that we would like to read for our dear listeners is titled What Happens in the Grave. So birth, death, and resurrection are the three stages which have been considered as the critical stages of human life. Because the transition from one life stage to the succeeding one is very complicated and difficult, or the proceeding one. Death is a journey into the unknown, but like any journey, it goes better if you are prepared. Now, we intend to discover the mysteries of the seemingly calm cemeteries to know what happens to the dead. Of course, we are also going to elaborate on the comforting factors in the grave. A. The secret of the burial night. The burial night would seem to be the first night after the burial of the body in the grave. But truly, it starts from the very moments of death, as it has little relation with the physical body. The first night in the grave is a relaxing night for believers and a horrible night for disbelievers and wrongdoers. This very important night for the deceased has various stages, such as the question of the grave. The grave in the Islamic notion refers to the world of barzakh, which is a place between the physical world and the non-physical one. Whenever the soul of a human being enters this world, two angels, Bashir and Mubashir, in confronting with the believers, and Nakir and Munkir, in confronting with disbelievers, will appear and ask certain questions. Like, who is your God? What is your religion? Who is your prophet? Who is your imam? Inshallah, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala enable us to answer these questions correctly, properly, and rightfully, inshallah, in our graves, with the blessings of the Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bookshelf on Iran Radio with Sheikh Yasser, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top headlines. Iran says its planned indirect talks with a U.S. in Amman on Saturday will test Washington's intent and seriousness. At least 18 Palestinians have been killed in fresh Israeli attacks on Gaza's southern city of Khan Yunis. And Yemenis have once again taken to the streets of Saada to express support for Palestinians in Gaza. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has described the planned indirect talks with the U.S. in the Omani capital on Saturday as a test to gauge Washington's intent and resolve. Smail Begay said in a social media post that Tehran is giving diplomacy a genuine chance. He noted that the Islamic Republic will assess the other side's seriousness on Saturday and will respond accordingly afterwards. Meanwhile, a senior advisor to leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said Tehran is seeking a real and fair agreement, noting that important and implement